Novus Ordo Seclorum.
Filipinos are a warm, gentle, caring, giving people, Avi says, which is a good thing, since so many of them carry concealed weapons. Randy is in Tokyo's airport, ambling down a concourse with a slowness that is infuriating to his fellow travelers. They have all spent the last half day strapped into bad chairs, stuffed into an aluminum tube aslosh with jet fuel. Over the safety-engineered nubs molded into the jetway floor, their rolling suitcases drone like fighter planes. They graze the backs of his knees as they bank around his husky columnar body. Randy is holding his new GSM phone to the side of his head. Supposedly, it works anywhere in the world except for the United States. This is his first chance to try it out.
"You sound clear as a bell," Avi says. "How was the flight over?"
"All right," Randy says. "They had one of those animated maps up on the video screen."
Avi sighs. "All the airlines have those now," he announces monotonically.
"The only feature between San Francisco and Tokyo is Midway Island."
"So?"
"It kind of hung there for hours. Midway. Mute embarrassment all around."
Randy reaches the departure gate for Manila and pauses to admire a 5-foot-wide high-definition TV set bearing the logo of a major Nipponese consumer electronics company. It is running a video in which a wacky cartoon professor and his adorable canine sidekick cheerfully tick off the 3 transmission routes of the AIDS virus.
"I have a fingerprint for you," Randy says.
"Shoot."
Randy stares at the palm of his hand, on which he has written a string of numbers and letters in ballpoint pen.
AF10069 99 BA 11 0764 C1 89 E3 40 8 C 7255.
"Got it," Avi says. "That's from Ordo, right?"
"Right. I emailed you the key from SFO.
"The apartment situation is still resolving," Avi says. "So I just reserved you a suite at the Manila Hotel."
"What do you mean, it's still resolving?"
"The Philippines is one of those post-Spanish countries with no clear boundaries between business and personal relationships," Avi says. "I don't think you can secure lodgings there without marrying into a family with a major street named after it."
Randy takes a seat in the departure area. Perky gate attendants in jaunty improbable hats zero in on Filipinos with too many carry-ons and subject them to a public ritual of filling out little tags and surrendering their possessions. The Filipinos roll their eyes and stare longingly out the windows. But most of the waiting passengers are Nipponese, some businessmen, mostly vacationers. They are watching an educational video about how to get mugged in foreign countries.
"Huh," Randy says, looking out the window. "Got another 747 down to Manila."
"In Asia, no decent airline bothers to dick around anything smaller than a 747,
Avi snaps.
"If someone tries to pack you on board a 737, or God forbid, an Airbus, run, don't walk, away from the boarding lounge and call me on my Sky Pager and I'll send in a chopper to evacuate you."
Randy laughs. Avi continues.
"Now listen, this hotel you're going to is very old, very grand, but it's in the middle of nowhere."
"Why would they build a grand hotel in the middle of nowhere?"
"It used to be a happening place. It's on the waterfront, right on the edge of Intramuros."
Randy's high school Spanish is enough to translate that. Inside the walls.
"But Intramuros was annihilated by the Nipponese in 1945, Avi continues. "Systematically. All of the business hotels and office buildings are in a new neighborhood called Makati, much closer to the airport."
"So you want to put our office in Intramuros?"
"How'd you guess?"
Avi says, sounding a little spooked. He prides himself on unpredictability.
"I'm not an intuitive guy generally," Randy says, "but I've been on a plane for 13 hours and my brain has been turned inside out and hung up to dry."
Avi rattles off canned justifications. Office space is much cheaper in Intramuros. Government ministries are closer. Makati, the gleaming new business district, is too isolated from the real Philippines. Randy pays no attention to it.
"You want to work out of Intramuros because it was systematically annihilated, and because you're obsessed with the Holocaust," Randy finally says, quietly and without rancor.
Yeah. So?
Avi says.
Randy stares out the window of the Manila-bound 747, sipping on a fluorescent green Nipponese soft drink made from bee extracts. At least it has pictures of bees on it, and munching on something that a flight attendant handed him called Japanese snack. Sky and ocean are the same color, a shade of blue that makes his teeth freeze. The plane is so high that whether he looks up or down, he sees foreshortened views of boiling cumulonimbus stacks. The clouds erupt from the hot Pacific as if immense warships were exploding all over the place. The speed and power of their growth is alarming, the forms they adopt as bizarre and varied as those of deep-sea organisms, and all of them, he supposes, are as dangerous to an airplane as punji steaks to a barefoot pedestrian. The red-orange meatball painted on the wingtip startles him when he notices it. He feels like he's been thrown into an old war film. He turns on his laptop. Electronic mail from Avi, encrypted to a fare-thee-well, has been piling up in his inbox. It is a gradual accumulation of tiny files thrown at him by Avi whenever a thought popped into his head over the last 3 days. It would be obvious, even if Randy didn't know it, that Avi owns a portable email machine that talks to the internet by radio. Randy fires up a piece of software that is technically called Novus Ordo Seclorum, but that everyone calls Ordo for short. It is a fairly strained pun based on the fact that Ordo's job as a piece of cryptographic software is to put a message's bits in a new order and that it will take centuries for nosy governments to decrypt it. A scanned image of a great pyramid appears in the middle of his screen, and a single eye gradually materializes at its apex. Ordo can handle this in one of two ways. The obvious way is to decrypt all of the messages and convert them into plain text files on his hard disk, which he can then read any time he wants. The problem with this, if you are paranoid, is that anyone who gets his hands on Randy's hard disk can then read the files. For all he knows, the customs officials in Manila will decide to ransack his computer for child pornography, or, fogged by jet lag, he'll leave his laptop in a taxi. So instead, he puts Ordo into a streaming mode, where it will decrypt the files just long enough for him to read them, and then, when he closes the windows, expunge the plain text from the computer's memory and from its hard drive. The subject heading of Avi's first message is Guideline 1. We look for places where math is right. Meaning what? Meaning that population is about to explode. We can predict that just by looking at age histogram. And per capita income is about to take off the way it did in Nippon, Taiwan, Singapore. Multiply those two things together and you get the kind of exponential growth that should get us all into fuck you money before we turn 40. This is an allusion to a Randy Avi conversation of 2 years ago wherein Avi actually calculated a specific numerical value for fuck you money. It was not a fixed constant, however, but rather a cell in a spreadsheet linked to any number of continually fluctuating economic indicators. Sometimes, when Avi is working at his computer, he will leave the spreadsheet running in a tiny window in the corner so that he can see the current value of fuck you money at a glance. The second message, sent a couple of hours later, is called Guideline 2. 2. Pick a tech where no one can compete with us. Right now, that equals networking. We're kicking the crap out of everyone else in the world when it comes to networking. It's not even funny. The next day, Avi sent a message called simply, More. Perhaps he had lost track of the number of guidelines he had issued so far. Another principle. This time we retain control of the corporation. That means that we keep at least 50% of the shares, which means little to no outside investment until we've built up some value.
You don't have to convince me, Randy mumbles to himself as he reads this.
This shapes the kinds of businesses we can get into. Forget anything that requires a big initial investment. Luzon is green-black jungle mountains, gouged with rivers that would appear to be avalanches of silt. As the navy blue ocean verges on its khaki beaches, the water takes on a shocking iridescent hue of a suburban swimming pool. Farther south, the mountains are swidden-scarred, the soil beneath is bright red, and so these parts look like fresh lacerations. But most is covered with foliage that looks like the nubby green stuff that model railroaders put over their papier-mâché hills. And in vast stretches of the mountains, there are no signs whatsoever that human beings have ever existed. Closer to Manila, some of the slopes are deforested, sprinkled with structures, ribboned with power line cuts. Rice paddies line the basins. The towns are accretions of shanties, nucleated around large, cross-shaped churches with good roofs. The view gets blurry as they belly down into the pall of sweaty smog above the city. The plane begins to sweat like a giant glass of iced tea. The water streams off in sheets, collects in crevices, whips off the flaps' trailing edges. Suddenly they are banking over Manila Bay, which is marked with endless streaks of brilliant red, some kind of algal bloom. Oil tankers trail long-time-delayed rainbows that flourish in their wakes. Every cove is jammed with long, skinny boats with dual outriggers, looking like brightly painted water skaters. And then they are down on the runway at Naya, Ninoy Aquino International Airport. Guards and cops of various stripes are ambling around with M16s or pistol-handled pump shotguns, wearing burnouses fashioned from handkerchiefs, clamped to the head with American baseball caps. A man dressed in a radiant white uniform stands below the ragged mob of the jetway, holding his hands downward with fluorescent orange sticks in them, like Christ dispensing mercy on a world of sinners. Sulfurous, fulminating tropical air begins to leak in through the jumbo's air vents. Everything moistens and wilts. He is in Manila. He takes his passport out of his shirt pocket. It says, Randall Lawrence Waterhouse. This is how Epiphyte Corporation came into existence. I am channeling the bad shit, Abby said. The number came through on Randy's pager while he was sitting around a table in a grubhouse along the coast with his girlfriend's crowd, a place where every day they laser-printed fresh menus on 100% recycled imitation parchment, where oscilloscope tracings of neon-colored sauces scribbled across the plates, and the entrees were towering architectonic stacks of rare ingredients carved into gem-like prisms. Randy had spent the entire meal trying to resist the temptation to invite one of Charlene's friends, any one of them, it didn't matter, out on the sidewalk for a fist fight. He glanced at his pager, expecting to see the number of the three siblings' computer center, which was where he worked, technically still does. The fell digits of Abby's phone number penetrated the core of his being in the same way that 666 would a fundamentalist's. 15 seconds later, Randy was out on the sidewalk, swiping his card through a payphone like an assassin drawing a single-edged razor blade across the throat of a tubby politician. "The power is coming down from on high," Abby continued. "Tonight it happens to be coming through me, you poor bastard."
"What do you want me to do?" Randy asked, adopting a cold, almost hostile tone to mask sick excitement.
"Buy a ticket to Manila," Abby said.
"I have to talk it over with Charlene first," Randy said.
"You don't even believe that yourself," Abby said.
"Charlene and I have a long-standing relationship."
"It's been 10 years. You haven't married her. Fill in the fucking blanks."
72 hours later, he would be in Manila, looking at the one-note flute.
"Everyone in Asia is wondering when the Philippines is finally going to get its shit together," Abby said. "It's the question of the 90s.
The one-note flute is the first thing you see when you make it through passport control.
"I flashed on this when I was standing in line at passport control in Ninoy Aquino International Airport," Abby said, compressing that entire name into a single, sharply articulated burst. "You know how they have different lanes?"
"I guess so," Randy said.
A parallel biped of seared tuna did a barrel roll in his gullet. He felt a perverse craving for a double ice cream cone. He did not travel as much as Abby and had only a vague idea of what he meant by lanes.
"You know, one lane for citizens, one for foreigners, maybe one for diplomats."
Now, standing there waiting to have his passport stamped, Randy can see it clearly. For once, he doesn't mind the wait. He gets in a lane next to the OCW lane and studies them. They are Epiphyte Corp's market. Mostly young women, many of them fashionably dressed, but still with a kind of Catholic boarding school demureness. Exhausted from long flights, tired of the wait, they slump, then suddenly straighten up and elevate their fine chins, as if an invisible nun were making her way up the line, whacking their manicured knuckles with a ruler. But 72 hours ago, he hadn't really understood what Avi meant by lanes, so he just said,
"Yeah, I've seen the lane thing.
At Manila, they have a whole lane just for returning OCWs.
OCWs?
Overseas contract workers. Filipinos working abroad, because the economy of the Philippines is so lame. As maids and nannies in Saudi, nurses and anesthesiologists in the States, singers in Hong Kong, whores in Bangkok."
Whores in Bangkok? Randy had been there, at least, and his mind reeled at the concept of exporting prostitutes to Thailand.
"The Filipino women are more beautiful," Avi said quietly, "and have a ferocity that makes them more interesting to the innately masochistic business traveler than all those grinning Thai bimbos."
Both of them knew that this was complete bullshit. Avi was a family man and had no first-hand experience whereof he spoke. Randy didn't call him on it, though. As long as Avi retained this extemporaneous bullshitting ability, there was a better-than-even chance of all of them making fuck-you money. Now that he's here, it is tempting to speculate as to which of the girls in the OCW lane are hustlers. But he can't see that going anywhere but wrong, so he squares his shoulders and marches toward the yellow line. The computer finally beeps. Randy rests his tired hand. Ordo politely warns him that it may be busy for a while, and then goes to work. It is searching the cosmos of pure numbers, looking for two big primes that can be multiplied by each other to produce a number 4,096 bits long. If you want your secrets to remain secret past the end of your life expectancy, then in order to choose a key length, you have to be a futurist. You have to anticipate how much faster computers will get during this time. You must also be a student of politics, because if the entire world were to become a police state obsessed with recovering old secrets, then vast resources might be thrown at the problem of factoring large composite numbers. So the length of the key that you use is, in and of itself, a code of sorts. A knowledgeable government eavesdropper, noting Randy's and Avi's use of a 4,096-bit key, will conclude one of the following. Avi doesn't know what he's talking about. This can be rolled out with a bit of research into his past accomplishments. Or, Avi is clinically paranoid. This can also be ruled out with some research. Or, Avi is extremely optimistic about the future development of computer technology, or pessimistic about the political climate, or both. Or, Avi has a planning horizon that extends over a period of at least a century. Randy paces around his room while his computer soars through number space. The shipping containers on the backs of those trucks bear exactly the same logos as the ones that used to fill the streets of South Seattle when a ship was unloading. To Randy, this is oddly satisfying, as if by making this crazy lunge across the Pacific, he has brought some kind of antipodal symmetry to his life. He has gone from the place where things are consumed to where they are produced. From a land where onanism has been enshrined at the highest levels of the society to one where cars have "no" to contraception stickers in their windows, it feels bizarrely right. He has not felt this way since Avi and he founded their first doomed business venture 12 years ago. Randy grew up in a college town in eastern Washington state, graduated from the University of Washington in Seattle, and landed a clerk typist 2 job at the library there, specifically the interlibrary loan department, where his job was to process incoming loan requests mailed in from smaller libraries all over the region, and conversely, to mail out requests to other libraries. If 9-year-old Randy Waterhouse had been able to look into the future and see himself in this career, he would have been delighted beyond measure. The primary tool of the interlibrary loan department was the staple remover. Young Randy had seen one of these devices in the hands of his 4th-grade teacher and been enthralled by its cunning and deadly appearance, so like the jaws of some futuristic robot dragon. He had, in fact, gone out of his way to staple things incorrectly just so he could prevail on his teacher to unstaple them, giving him another glimpse of the blood-chilling mandibles in action.
He had gone so far as to steal a staple remover from an untended desk at church, and then incorporate it into an Erector-set robot hunter-killer device with which he terrorized much of the neighborhood. Its pit viper yawn separated many a cheap plastic toy from its parts and accessories before the theft was discovered and Randy made an example of before God and man. Now, in the interlibrary loan office, Randy had not just one but several staple removers in his desk drawer and was actually obligated to use them for an hour or two a day. Since the UW library was well endowed, its patrons didn't request books from other libraries unless they had been stolen from their own or were in some way peculiar. The ill office, as Randy and his co-workers affectionately called it, had its regulars, people who had a whole lot of peculiar books on their wish lists. These people tended to be either tedious or scary or both. Randy always ended up dealing with the both subgroup, because Randy was the only clerk typist in the office who was not a lifer. It seemed clear that Randy, with his astronomy degree and his extensive knowledge of computers, would one day move on, whereas his co-workers did not harbor further ambitions. His larger sphere of interests, his somewhat broader concept of normalcy, was useful when certain patrons came into the office. By the standards of many, Randy was himself a tedious, scary, obsessed character. He was not merely obsessed with science, but also with fantasy role-playing games. The only way he could tolerate working at such a stupid job for a couple of years was that his off-time was completely occupied with enacting fantasy scenarios of a depth and complexity that exercised all of the cranial circuitry that was so conspicuously going to waste in the ill office. He was part of a group that would meet every Friday night and play until sometime on Sunday. The other stalwarts in the group were a computer science music double major named Chester and a history grad student named Avi. When a new master's degree candidate named Andrew Loeb walked into the ill office one day with a certain glint in his eye and produced a 3-inch stack of precisely typed request forms from his shitty old knapsack, he was recognized immediately as being of a particular type and shunted in the direction of Randy Waterhouse. It was an instant meeting of minds, though Randy did not fully realize this until the books that Loeb had requested began to arrive on the trolley from the mailroom. Andy Loeb's project was to figure out the energy budgets of the local Indian tribes. A human body has to expend a certain amount of energy just to keep breathing and to maintain its body temperature. This figure goes up when it gets cold or when the body in question is doing work. The only way to obtain that energy is by eating food. Some foods have a higher energy content than others. For example, trout is highly nutritious, but so low in fat and carbohydrates that you can starve to death eating it 3 times a day. Other foods might have lots of energy, but might require so much work to obtain and prepare that eating them would be a losing proposition. Andy Loeb was trying to figure out what foods had historically been eaten by certain Northwest Indian tribes, how much energy they expended to get these foods, and how much they obtained by eating them. He wanted to do this calculation for coastal Indians like the Salish, who had easy access to seafood, and for inland ones like the Cayuse, who didn't, as part of an extremely convoluted plan to prove some sort of point about the relative standards of living of these tribes and how this affected their cultural development. Coastal tribes made lots of fantastically detailed art, and inland ones occasionally scratched stick figures on rocks. To Andrew Loeb, it was an exercise in metahistorical scholarship. To Randy Waterhouse, it sounded like the beginnings of a pretty cool game. Strangle a muskrat, and you get 136 energy points. Lose the muskrat, and your core temp drops another degree. Andy was nothing if not methodical, and so he had simply looked up every book that had ever been written on such topics, and every book mentioned in those books' bibliographies, yea, even unto 4 or 5 generations, checked out all of them that were available locally, and ordered the rest from Ill. All of the latter passed across Randy's desk. Randy read some and skimmed all. He got to learn about how much blubber the Arctic explorers had to eat in order to keep from starving to death. He perused detailed specifications for Army sea rations. After a while, he actually began sneaking into the photocopy room and making copies of key data. In order to run a realistic fantasy role-playing game, you had to keep track of how much food the imaginary characters were getting and how much trouble was involved in getting it. Characters passing across the Gobi Desert in November of the year 5000 BC would have to spend more time worrying about food than, say, ones who were traveling across central Illinois in 1950. Randy was hardly the first game designer to notice this. There were a few incredibly stupid games in which you didn't have to think about food, but Randy and his friends disdained them. In all of the games that he participated in, or that he himself designed, you had to devote a realistic amount of effort to getting food for your character. But it was not easy to determine what was realistic. Like most designers, Randy got over the problem by slapping together a few rudimentary equations that he basically just pulled out of thin air. But in the books, articles, and dissertations that Andrew Loeb was borrowing through ill, he found exactly the raw data that a mathematically inclined person would need to come up with a sophisticated rule system based on scientific fact. Simulating all of the physical processes going on in each character's body was out of the question, especially in a game where you might be dealing with armies of 100,000 men. Even a crude simulation, tracking only a few variables and using simple equations, would involve a nightmarish amount of paperwork, if you did it all by hand. But all of this was happening in the mid-1980s, when personal computers had become cheap and ubiquitous. A computer could automatically track a large database and tell you whether each character was well-fed or starving. There was no reason not to do it on a computer. Unless, like Randy Waterhouse, you had such a shitty job that you couldn't afford a computer. Of course, there's a way to dodge any problem. The university had lots of computers. If Randy could get an account on one of them, he could write his program there and run it for free. Unfortunately, accounts were only available to students or faculty members, and Randy was neither. Fortunately, he started dating a grad student named Charlene at just about this time. How the hell did a generally keg-shaped guy, a hard scientist, working a dead-end clerk-typist job, and spending all his spare time in the consummately nerdy pastime of fantasy role-playing games, end up in a relationship with a slender and not unattractive young liberal arts student who spent her spare time sea kayaking and going to foreign films? It must have been one of those opposites attract kind of deals, a complementary relationship. They met, naturally, in the ill office, where the highly intelligent but steady and soothing Randy helped the highly intelligent but scattered and flighty Charlene organize a messy heap of loan requests. He should have asked her out then and there, but he was shy. Second and third opportunities came along when the books she'd requested began to filter up from the mailroom, and finally he asked her out, and they went to see a film together. Both of them turned out to be not just willing, but eager and possibly even desperate. Before they knew it, Randy had given Charlene a key to his apartment, and Charlene had given Randy the password to her free university computer account, and everything was just delightful. The university computer system was better than no computer at all, but Randy was humiliated. Like every other high-powered academic computing network, this one was based on an industrial-strength operating system called Unix, which had a learning curve like the Matterhorn, and lacked the cuddly and stylish features of the personal computers then coming into vogue. Randy had used it quite a bit as an undergraduate and knew his way around. Even so, learning how to write good code on the thing required a lot of time. His life had changed when Charlene had come along, and now it changed more. He dropped out of the fantasy role-playing game circuit altogether, stopped going to meetings of the Society for Creative Anachronism, and began to spend all of his free time either with Charlene or in front of a computer terminal. All in all, this was probably a change for the better. With Charlene, he did things he wouldn't have done otherwise, like getting exercise or going to see live music. And at the computer, he was learning new skills, and he was creating something. It might be something completely useless, but at least he was creating. He spent a lot of time talking to Andrew Loeb, who actually went out and did the stuff he was writing programs for. He'd disappear for a few days and come back all wobbly and haggard, with fish scales caught in his whiskers or dried animal blood under his fingernails. He'd ram down a couple of Big Macs, sleep for 24 hours, then meet Randy in a bar. Charlene wasn't comfortable with having him in the house, and talk learnedly of the difficulties of day-to-day life, Aboriginal style. They argued about whether Aborigines would eat more disgusting parts of certain animals or throw them away. Andrew voted for yes. Randy disagreed. Just because they were primitive didn't mean they couldn't have taste. Andrew accused him of being a romantic. Finally, to settle it, they went up into the mountains together, armed with nothing but knives and Andrew's collection of exquisitely crafted vermin snares. By the third night, Randy found himself seriously thinking about eating some insects. QED, Andrew said. Anyway, Randy finished his software after a year and a half. It was a success. Chester and Abby liked it. Randy was moderately pleased at having built something so complicated that actually worked, but he had no illusions about its being good for anything. He was sort of embarrassed at having wasted so much time and mental energy on the project, but he knew that if he hadn't been writing code, he'd have spent the same amount of time playing games or going to Society for Creative Anachronism meetings in medieval drag, so it all zeroed out in the end. Spending the time in front of the computer was arguably better because it had honed his programming skills, which had been pretty sharp to begin with. On the other hand, he had done it all on the Unix system, which was for scientists and engineers. Not a savvy move in an age when all the money was in personal computers. Chester and Randy had nicknamed Avi Avid because he really, really liked fantasy games. Avi had always claimed that he played them as a way of understanding what it was really like to live in ancient times, and he was a maniac about historical authenticity. That was okay. They all had half-assed excuses, and Avi's historical acumen frequently came in handy. Not long after this, Avi graduated and disappeared, and popped up a few months later in Minneapolis, where he had gotten a job with a major publisher of fantasy role-playing games. He offered to buy Randy's game software for the astonishingly large sum of $1,000, plus a small cut of future profits. Randy accepted the offer in its general outlines, asked Avi to send him a contract, then went out and found Andrew boiling some fish guts in a birch bark kettle atop a Weber grill on the roof of the apartment building where he lived. He wanted to give Andrew the good news and to cut him in on the proceeds. What ensued was a really unpleasant conversation, standing up there in a pelting, spitting, wind-blown rain. To begin with, Andrew took this deal far more seriously than Randy did. Randy saw it as a windfall, a lark. Andrew, who was the son of a lawyer, treated it as if it were a major corporate merger, and asked many tedious and niggling questions about the contract, which did not exist yet and which would probably cover a single piece of paper when it did. Randy didn't realize it at the time, but by asking so many questions for which Randy had no answers, Andrew was, in effect, arrogating to himself the role of business manager. He was implicitly forming a business partnership with Randy that did not, in fact, exist. Furthermore, Andrew didn't have the first notion of how much time and effort Randy had put into writing the code. Or, as Randy was to realize later, maybe he did. In any case, Andrew assumed from the get-go that he would share a 50-50 split with Randy, which was wildly out of proportion to the work he'd actually done on the project. Basically, Andrew acted as if all the work he'd ever done on the subject of Aboriginal dining habits was a part of this undertaking, and that it entitled him to an equal split. By the time Randy extricated himself from this conversation, his mind was reeling. He had gone in with one view of reality and been radically challenged by another one that was clearly preposterous. But after an hour of Andrew's browbeating, he was beginning to doubt himself. After two or three sleepless nights, he decided to call the whole thing off. A paltry few $100 wasn't worth all of this agony. But Andrew, who was by now represented by an associate of his father's Santa Barbara law firm, vehemently objected. He and Randy had, according to his lawyer, jointly created something that had economic value, and a failure on Randy's part to sell it at market value amounted to taking money out of Andrew's pocket. It had become an unbelievable Kafkaesque nightmare, and Randy could only withdraw to a corner table at his favorite pub, drink pints of stout, frequently in the company of Chester, and watch this fantastic psychodrama unfold. He had, he now realized, blundered into some serious domestic weirdness involving Andrew's family. It turned out that Andrew's parents were divorced and long ago had fought savagely over custody of him, their only child. Mom had turned into a hippie and joined a religious cult in Oregon and taken Andrew with her. It was rumored that this cult engaged in sexual abuse of children. Dad had hired private dicks to kidnap Andrew back and then showered him with material possessions to demonstrate his superior love. There had followed an interminable legal battle, in which Dad had hired some rather fringy psychotherapists to hypnotize Andrew and get him to dredge up repressed memories of unspeakable and improbable horrors. This was just the executive summary of a weird life that Randy had only learned about in bits and pieces as the years went on. Later, he was to decide that Andrew's life had been fractally weird. That is, you could take any small piece of it and examine it in detail, and it, in and of itself, would turn out to be just as complicated and weird as the whole thing in its entirety. Anyway, Randy had blundered into this life and become enveloped in the weirdness. One of the young eager beavers in Andrew's dad's law firm decided, as a preemptive move, to obtain copies of all of Randy's computer files, which were still stored on the UW computer system. Needless to say, he went about it in a heavy-handed way, and when the university's legal department began to receive his sullen letters, it responded by informing both Andrew's lawyer and Randy that anyone who used the university's computer system to create a commercial product had to split the proceeds with the university. So now Randy was getting ominous letters from not one, but two groups of deadly lawyers. Andrew then threatened to sue him for having made this blunder, which had halved the value of Andrew's share. In the end, just to cut his losses and get out of it clean, Randy had to hire a lawyer of his own. The final cost to him was a hair more than $5,000. The software was never sold to anyone, and indeed could not have been. It was so legally encumbered by that point that it would have been like trying to sell someone a rusty Volkswagen that had been dismantled and its parts hidden in attack dog kennels all over the world. It was the only time in his life when he had ever thought about suicide. He did not think about it very hard or very seriously, but he did think about it. When it was all over, Abby sent him a handwritten letter saying, "I enjoyed doing business with you, and look forward to continuing our relationship both as friends and, should opportunities arise, as creative partners."